Hello and welcome to this week's episode of QS Cast, your weekly financial podcast brought to you by QuietSpeculation.com. We have a lot to talk about this week. We have three amazing constructed tournaments to dig through the top eight of. So get ready, and we are joined here today by Kelly.
Hello.
And Chaz.
How's it going?
And I'm your host, Doug, and we are going to be talking about things. We have two modern tournaments to talk about. So we'll bunch those together. First, we want to talk about Grand Prix Indianapolis. There were a lot of hopes going into this tournament, hopes that it would not be just the same Jeskai, Abzan, Atarka Red, Green-White Megamorph format, and we were richly rewarded. I'm happy to see this, and I'm happy that week-to-week the metagame is changing. So I wanted to toss this over to you, Kelly. Maybe you can tell us the bird's-eye view of what you love about this top eight.
The lack of Jace. There are four copies of Jace in the top eight, one of which was Patrick Chapin. And then, crucially, there were, I believe, 20-plus copies of Jace in the 9 through 32 bracket. That tells me that Jace, the people showed up with Jace, and he is very well represented, but ultimately did not perform well enough to get to top eight. Now, the only person who made top eight with Jace is a masterful, masterful control player, Patrick Chapin. So everybody else played what was basically some sort of fairly linear aggro deck. And it's clear that some of these aggro decks just hit too hard, too fast for Jace decks to keep up with. It says a lot that the only control deck played in the top eight was by someone who knew what they were doing. Because looking at like Ray Perez's token deck or Valentin Mackel's Bant Megamorph deck, using Knight of the White Orchid, which we'll get back to in a moment, Frank Clausen's tournament-winning, pretty much stock Abzan list. There's nothing new about this at all. It's just a straight-up Abzan list, and he probably just played it better than anybody else who played Abzan. Jace decks just can't compete with cards that are that powerful, that undercosted, especially when, you know, they're also going up against, like, Scott Kirkwood's Red-Green Landfall deck, where you've got your, you know, again, pretty much stock, maybe the inclusion of Den Protector was not as common. He played Den Protectors over Zergo. He only played one Zergo. Giving it some more mid-range options, buying back any card in your deck is pretty good. And then you've got Daniel Chan's Blue Abzan deck, which I love the splash of blue. I think that splashing blue and Abzan is a really interesting choice, especially like in the Hardened Scales deck, which was more banned than Abzan. Splashing for Stubborn Denial is something that I was playing with early in the format. Considering how many creatures you have with power 4 or greater, it's basically just a hard counter that keeps all your stuff alive. I just love that the top 8 is almost Jace-less, because I think that that card dominating the format makes Standard too expensive for new players. There wasn't a single Jeskai deck in the top 8, and then looking through the 9 through 13, I see a few, but again, a lot of Abzan decks and a lot of Green-White Megamorph decks.
Yeah, I can attribute a lot of that. I did the counting. Five of the top eight decks are running Wingmate Rock, and Wingmate Rock lines up quite well against decks running Jace because you get two heavy hitters, and a Crackling Doom can only kill one. So it's I was surprised. It's kind of like Wingmate Rock and Jace have flipped week to week in how common they are. So I was pleased to see that. Again, the financial tip, Wingmate Rock is still an ascendant card. I think it's still a good card. Every format seems to have a dragon in it, like the $20 dragon, and this looks like it right now.
I would just be careful that it only has less than 6 months left in the format. Still, it's been underpriced for quite some time. We saw its star has been rising for the last couple weeks. But Doug, you mentioned Craig Wesco's black-white aggro deck seeming really interesting. The rundown, if you're not familiar, it's using Mardu, this is a great word, Duo Reaper, say that five times fast, Kithion, Knight of the White Orchid, Wasteland Strangler, the Eldrazi Processor, Archangel of Tithes, Wingmate Rock, Transgress the Mind, Mastery of the Unseen, Silk Wrap, Stasis Snare. The idea is you use Silk Wrap, Stasis Snare, Transgress the Mind to exile things to Wasteland Strangler, and then Wasteland Strangler turns into an undercosted 2-for-1 when you unexile the thing that you Stasis Snared or Silk Wrapped. Wesco really, you know, he's one of the best in the world. He came in 18th at this tournament, which is just outside of top 16, but that still means he placed pretty highly, and one or two bad matchups or mulligans might have kept him out of top 8. The deck seems fairly cheap. All the mythics in it are undercosted compared to their power level, Archangel of Tithes and Kithion. Mana base is kind of rough. It does have 10 fetch lands in it. But again, four Shambling Vent, yet another Shambling Vent deck. I mean, that card is just playing everywhere. I like this deck because it's really super aggressive. It's got a ton of 2-power-1 drops, just like these red decks are starting to show. But then it's got Knight of the White Orchid as a 4 of. And reading about what people thought about this card, the phrase I heard most often is it steals tempo or it steals the play back when you're on the draw. I think a big reason for that is its first strike. Two power first strike can stop a lot of things in the format dead in their tracks, and then getting an extra land, obviously, just its mana acceleration, the land even comes into play untapped, and it can fetch the new battle lands because it doesn't say basic planes, it says any planes. So all things considered, the deck is packed with value. It's super, super aggressive. It's got some really good interactions like Silk Wrap and Wasteland Strangler. And overall, I wish he had done a little bit better so this deck got more press. But I think we should definitely keep our eye on this sort of shell because the majority of it remains intact after rotation.
Definitely. I was looking at, you know, Ray Perez Jr.'s deck also runs Four Knight of the White Orchid. Great card because that deck really plans to be hitting a Planeswalker on turn four if it can. So even being able to jamming a Gideon on turn three seems really busted if you're on the draw and you can play a Knight of the White Orchid. I mean, I would be inclined to let my opponent go first if I knew that I could set that up every time. So, you know,
so
another deck using the Knight.
Real quick, I just did the math. Knight of the White Orchid, there were 28 copies in the top 32.
That's impressive.
I mean, every deck,
and when we see
every deck ran four that ran it.
Yeah, when we see a reprint, we're always wondering, like, why is this here? Is this going to be good in the new format? Like, Meddling Mage didn't do anything when it was reprinted. I had the same low bar and barrier for Knight of the White Orchid. It's really overperformed, though.
Yeah, let's not forget that this card was very, very good when it was printed initially. So it's great to see an old favorite getting reprinted and doing some real damage. I mean, what's interesting is it's not a spectacular, sexy card that does game-breaking things, but it does so much for its mana cost. It's one of those silent value cards where I don't think people quite appreciate. This was probably the breakout card of the tournament. I mean, it was everywhere in the top 32 to the extent that no other previously unseen card was. I mean, no one was running this at the Pro Tour, right? And that was 2 weeks ago. Yet now the top 32 is just littered with them. I mean, that's really impressive, and I think that qualifies as breakout. Everything else was pretty much a known quantity.
I think that Patrick's deck was kind of the logical conclusion of where Esper Dragons was supposed to go. And, you know, it's a Pat Chapin deck. Yeah, you see that he has, for example, a main deck, Hallowed Moonlight, which if you guys don't remember from Origins Draft, it's that crappy rare that prevents tokens from entering the battlefield, basically, and it cantrips. He has...
it also stops Deathless Raptor from coming back.
Yeah, that's true. It has a single Surge of Righteousness, with the idea being that you can use a card like Jace to buy back one of these very potent one-ofs. So when you see... when you see something like the one of Silumgar's Command or, you know, like the Painful Truths on the sideboard, that's because Jace makes every one of those cards better. I'm not saying anything new and revelatory here, but I had figured a few weeks ago we'd start to see decks running things like the main deck one of Surge of Righteousness or Self-Inflicted Wound to get all that value off the Jace, because the times when you don't have that, when you're not playing an opponent with green, you can just pitch it. But the times when you're playing an opponent with green, then you want a Self-Inflicted Wound them, then that's going to be awesome.
And you can then recast it and get double value.
Absolutely.
It's really the best of both worlds. Real quick about Pat's deck, the two planar outburst was a really interesting inclusion. I mean, he's not playing this for a 5-mana wrath. He's playing this because he knows he's going to get to 8 mana. And on 8 mana, if he doesn't have an Ugin, he's got a board wipe that gives him a 4/4. That's definitely not as good as Ugin the Spirit Dragon, but it's certainly different. Ugin just, it can wipe the board, but this wipes the board and leaves you in a strong board position, as opposed to having to rebuild your Ugin back up by lightning bolting them every turn, which I guess seems fine too.
There's this interesting strategic line where players are now, so David Phelps did this, who was running Bant Hardened Scales. Ray Perez did this. And then Daniel Chan also did this. They're running one or two blue dual lands and getting them with their fetches. And it supports things like Negate and Dispel off of the sideboard. And it's interesting to see that because that's kind of one of those like slight edges that players are putting in. David Phelps with his Bant Hardened Scales committed the most because he has 4 Stubborn Denial in it. But this is one of those strategies that you consider with your friends when you're testing, like, you know, what if I put some counter spells in this deck and nobody will assume it's coming from Abzan, and then, you know, you dismiss it. But here we have 3 players who essentially just ran a couple blue spells.
That's
just
what
to run
Dark
some counter
Jeskai
spells.
Came back with That's how Dark Jeskai came about. It's because that fourth, I've heard over and over, that fourth color is a free roll, and it almost makes your deck better, not only by expanding the options you have available, but because it actually makes your mana base smoother, which is very counterintuitive.
Now you can negotiate with the stack too. That if you're playing Abzan and you're not tapped out, you know your opponent has to respect the ability that you're going to have a negate. And
yeah,
when we're
sure.
looking at more and more things like stopping planeswalkers and big powerful spells, that kind of stuff really matters.
And here's the real key is that you don't want to cast these spells on curve. Like when I was testing Abzan with blue, I made the mistake of trying to maximize my value with Skyrider Elf. But like the problem with Skyrider Elf is you generally want to cast him on 3 or 4, but you don't have the luxury of necessarily trying to find blue mana while you're also trying to assemble Abzan mana in those turns. Stubborn Denial is a 1-mana blue reactive spell that you may not even cast until the mid to late game, so same with Crackling Doom. It's not something you need to cast on 3 every game for your deck to work, so I think that's the key to making use of that fourth color, is not
needing
that's
it a good point.
Until late game.
You know, it was interesting to see like the one of dispel and like you guys are talking about the inclusion of Stubborn Denial, which basically turns on a lot in these decks. But I mean, just having a couple of them that you can fetch, I mean, it's so easy in standard. Just having that one dispel or one Stubborn Denial can really, obviously, it helped them get into the top 8. It's really good in those crucial situations, and they're not always game planning for that.
Yeah, and once they see a dispel in game one, if it was your one of, I mean, you can board it out because they don't know you only have it as a one of, and you can basically get the value of having a one of now in your sideboard in games 2 and 3, and they're going to play around it regardless of whether or not you even have it in your deck anymore.
Yeah, it's a little more cute when you're going through the tournament. I mean, when you're in the top 8, obviously they're going to see your deck list, so it's not as cute, but it's still good. I mean, it's going to help you get deep into a tournament, and then the top 8, obviously, it's going to continue to help.
If they know you've only got one of, they're not going to play around it, and then you can blow them out with it.
Right.
I looked at a lot of the standard stuff. I mean, the deck I'm most excited about here is the Hardened Scales deck. I know that we've been looking at Hardened Scales just on the fringes of things. I think this makes it a little bit more respectable. It's cool that you can run Den Protector, and basically, like, if you have the Hardened Scales, it just gets even better. That's amazing. I like the Abzan Falconer. I really like the Mana Gorger Hydra. And I wrote about this in my article for this week, that you can play something like Stubborn Denial or your Negates or whatever as like this old... Okay, it's not old. It's a strategy that you used to play in Legacy, which is where you run out a Tarmogoyf and then you just protect it for the rest of the game and kill somebody. Like, that's what Mana Gorger Hydra is here, and it's in Standard. It's old because it used to be what the Miracle-Gro decks would do with Quirion Dryad, but... Mana Gorger Hydra gets obscenely big on its own, and with Hardened Scales, it's like it's incomprehensible how huge that thing gets. You really have to kill it the turn it comes out.
Yeah, it definitely turned into like that miracle. I think it found its actual strategy is moving away towards really making sure everything gets +1/+1 counters to just getting one of those cards out and protecting it. I mean, they really turned the switch to their spells. Valorous Dance, Feat of Resistance, Dromoka's Command, Stubborn Denial. That's all just straight up trying to protect what's out there.
Absolutely. And, you know, the opponent who's banking on their Abzan Charm to remove your Mana Gorger Hydra is going to be having to respect the fact that there are 4 Stubborn Denials in the deck. And that's one of those things where even if you know that they're there, their presence looms large. Because now you have to wonder whether you're going to tap out on their turn to cast an Abzan Charm to draw cards, and whether you're just going to get blown out by a Force Spike. Like, Force Spike is hands down the most demoralizing spell to have cast against you. It's probably even worse than Daze, because, like, Daze, you're just like, okay, you got me. And Force Spike is like, I played the game and I lost. I knew you had an island up, and I still played the game and I lost.
Another thing is Feat of Resistance is actually a card you turned me onto in our testing. I didn't believe in it at first, but for some reason I think I thought it was 3 mana, not 2. Anyway, Feat of Resistance is an instant that puts a +1/+1 counter on a creature you control, and that creature gets protection from a color of your choice. Now imagine if they try to get cute and Abzan Charm away your Mana Gorger Hydra before a combat on your turn. Well, not only do you counter their removal spell, but now you've probably given it protection from one of the Abzan colors, and they're probably not going to be able to block the creature. And you've just made it 2 +1/+1 counters bigger, one for its trigger, one for feet, plus the one that Abzan Charm gave you, and then then you might even have a hardened scales out. So, like, you can see how this protect the queen strategy really works out well, because every time you try to protect it, it gets a lot bigger. It's way better than Tarmogoyf in that regard, and that the wars you fight over it only make it worse. Tarmogoyf kind of maxes out at like a 4-5 or a 5-6. This thing just gets arbitrarily huge over the course of the game.
And it tramples, too. I mean, it tramples, so you can be like, oh, I'm going to hold back a Hangerback Walker and block, and then it just, once you read the trample line, it's like, okay, you're dead, you know? It's a 9-9. It will kill you. It will go through every last stopper token you have.
I always forget that it has trample, because I look at the base 1-1 and I never think it has trample, but like trample and flying are two of the most important things in this format. Avatar of the Resolute, that's why it's so good, is because even without its +1/+1 counter ability, it's got reach and trample. It deals with those Hangerback tokens and it smashes right through them. So like Mana Gorger Hydra, also I love the two Abzan Falconers that gives each of your creatures +1/+1 counters given flying, and it can even start growing itself in the late game while sitting back on defense and or giving your team flying. So it's just a really synergistic deck, and I think he found the right mix of lands and spells and creatures to really go off with a deck that I've been trying to make work for months now. I think he has come closer than anybody else has, and the fact that he cracked the top 8 of this tournament kind of tells you everything you need to know.
Okay, is there any deck that beats the Hardened Scales as the coolest deck? Anybody want to advocate for anything else?
No, I mean, I'm more focused on what Modern was doing, but it was good to see that Standard is still able to kind of be a little diverse still, and it was nice to see, like, Jace not, that, you know, it wasn't everywhere, and a couple of other decks can thrive. So it's good to see, again, that Jace is going to start cooling off, and as we get closer to rotation, obviously that's going to help everything, because I think fetch lands really are driving a lot of the prices of Standard right now. So while it looks enticing, I mean, still we're looking at, you know, $500 decks plus, and while it is fun, I mean, not a lot of people are obviously wanting to shell out that kind of money. But I mean, even just red green landfall, I think is good. A deck that's worth playing, because obviously it's cheap and it sticks around for a while. So yeah, it was good to see it in fourth place.
Yeah, and I'll say as a postscript too, that we even had Valentine Mackle's deck also had 4 Disdainful Stroke. He was running Bant Megamorph, but you know, Bant just for running Disdainful Stroke. You know, before we leap over, what do you guys think of the long term prediction looking at very expensive Standard decks here that rotate so quickly? My intuition is that this is not good for the format. Do you think we'll see less people playing Standard, less people paying to play the expensive decks? And do you think Wizards is going to look at this as an experiment? I'm just going to throw this out to the group to jump in on this.
I think that this is an outlier. I think Jace is way overinflated compared to his actual power level. I think the price is somewhere in between what it was and what it has been. Fetchlands are obviously stupidly skewing the prices, since you probably need 10 of them in your deck and they cost about $20. That's mana base. Big expensive mana bases are probably the bane of Standard, because it keeps people, you need to have a certain buy-in in order to play the format whatsoever, and then when it's like, okay, now go get all your Jaces and you know, things like that, you're gonna be looking at too much of a buy-in. But I think that the rotation velocity will keep any card from being too dominant for too long, and I think eventually people will realize that prices are going to, I think it might temper prices slightly when you realize that, like, hey, I bought this Jace for $70, and then a year later it's gone. So I think eventually the people will stop paying that much for a card that's only going to be in Standard for so long. And the refrains of, oh, well, it'll be good in Modern, that's not really applicable to 95% of cards. I mean, the last couple sets, like Abbot of Carol Keep is good enough for Modern. Jace, probably good enough for Modern. Fetchlands, already been in Modern, but they won't propel the prices nearly as much as Standard did. I think that Wizards just have to be careful that they don't keep printing cards that will dominate a format, because I also think that Origins was printed in a bit of a short supply because of how and when it was released. So I think that's a big component in the Jace factor. And Fetchlands, just like, those were going to be a big money reprint no matter what. And they knew it, and they felt like it needed to be done for the health of the game. It probably was great for Modern, but short-term Standard suffered for it. So I think the rotation schedule will help temper prices. I think they will be more volatile, obviously, because we have a shorter time frame when everything is legal, and the metagame will kind of fluctuate more frequently, so cards have more of a chance to break out and more of a chance to get smacked down by the metagame. But overall, I think that we're in this transition phase. We can't really evaluate the impact of hyper-expensive standard with only this context to talk about. Like, the last time it was this bad was probably Zendikar era Cobblade.
It was Cobblade was the last time it was this high. I think Saffron Olive did the math on it.
Yeah.
It's just not sustainable.
It's not. You're right. We got to look at the next block, actually. It's going to be a return to Innistrad. So, yay to that. Hopefully they don't butcher it like they did Zendikar, but that's another story. The thing is, you're right, Kelly. It's going to be hard to have cards suddenly increase in price because of this new rotation schedule. So I think we're looking at a situation where instead of rotation being the focal point of what makes prices move, I think it's going to now switch to what's going to be good right off the bat. Like, what's going to be the Gideon Ally of Zendikar type card that's going to be good right away? And that's where you're going to have to start really sitting down and getting card evaluation, because that's where you're going to see the profits kind of switch. So they are going to print powerful cards. Like, there's going to be good cards, like, as Magic goes along. I mean, it's not going to be so downplayed in terms of a power level reset that they're never going to make powerful cards again. I mean, there's going to be good stuff. So, again, I think it's going to move the emphasis away from, okay, so I'm going to stock up on all these cards around rotation, to what's actually just going to be good right from the get-go. Like, what is the card in this set that's going to be defining the standard? And it's not going to be, like, there's going to be an expensive card, but I think it's going to alleviate the, well, you know, Jace is $70 and this is $70 and all these dual lands and fetch lands and all that, to there's going to be a couple pricey cards each block. You know, every block there's going to be, you know, the one or two cards that's good, and then the rest is going to be fairly inexpensive because, like you said, it's gravitating to, well, I'm not going to spend, you know, 60x dollars on every card when they're all going to be rotating. I think it's going to be easier to stomach, well, you know, this card is, you know, 15 bucks, whatever, you know, that's fine, if the rest of my deck is fairly inexpensive. So to answer your question, Doug, I think it'll keep people playing standard because of the gradual decrease of standard prices as we are well into this new cadence. So, yeah, it's a transitional phase. We're going to get the new block cadence, and as we get further into that new cadence, I think we're going to see, again, the shift from what cards do I stock up at rotation to what's actually just good right away, and predicting that.
I think that's good for the game, too, because a lot of people's complaints about, quote, Magic Finance are that people just hoard cards to make money and aren't playing with them. So I think that if we have a really direct, rapid feedback loop between supply, price, and demand, that will keep the price sane as opposed to garbage like $80 Jaces. And I think that the fact that prices iterate rapidly encourages people to move through positions and keep cards transacting on the market. Now, the more cards transact on the market, the better it is for everybody. You know, marketplaces take their fees, sellers make profits, buyers get the cards they want or need, and that cycle repeats as those cards wax and wane in gameplay utility. So I think we're going to see a shift more towards valuation based on pure gameplay utility as opposed to some concept of buy and hold. It's just there's not going to be enough time for buy and hold to be as profitable as it once might have been, and the rapid fluctuations of the market mean you will be rewarded for trading through positions as opposed to sitting on them. Overall, I think
absolutely.
It's a good
thing. Absolutely. Yeah, that is. And coupled with the fact that I think there is a good, healthy thing, while it doesn't look good like on paper sometimes, it's good that one or two cards are, you know, highly emphasized and then the rest of the cards. I mean, you can even look at this in cons a little bit, which is, I think, is where they're starting to go with these block developments is, you have the fetch lands, obviously, but then you have like Mantis Rider, Siege Rhino, all these staples that are like $1 or $2. So that coupled with just emphasizing a couple cards as being really good, that kind of drives down all the staples that you can, you know, play for, you know, even, you know, you look at Craig Wesco's deck list. I mean, there's a lot of those a lot of these cards, even in all these deck lists, that aren't super expensive. I mean, Mantis Rider is a defining card in Jeskai, and it's a, like a couple bucks when you look at in comparison to Jace. So,
and so look at
I
those
think,
cards, and how much was Mantis Rider for the majority of its tenure in Standard? About 50 cents to a dollar. How much is it now? Between 2 and 3. 2 and 3 is still a really reasonable price. It's less than the price of a booster pack. I mean, if you open a Mantis Rider in a $4 pack, you're net negative. That says a lot, because it's one of the best cards in the game right now. So I feel like if we have one or two headliners like Gideon that people are really chasing for, and then we've got cards like Mantis Rider, which despite being good, are 50 cents until they're great, at which point they're $2 or $3. Like, those are really sane and reasonable prices, and the relative scarcity of Gideon's, maybe that's inflating their price, but like, maybe that's just what happens when you have a really great standard tier one rare that's auto-included in any deck that can cast it. I'm not against $40 planeswalkers. I'm against $80 planeswalkers. And I think that the $40 ones, there can't be more than one at a time, and they need to be on such a power level that, like, even cards like Mantis Rider don't look as good in comparison.
Yeah, it's shocking also, you know, with the mana bases right now, that you can add a card like Crackling Doom, which is a $3 card, and it increases the value of the deck by $300, because now you have to run the lands with it. You know, one of the benefits of having the lands be so expensive is that everything else is cheap enough that, yeah, I mean, it's like if you bit the bullet and you got all the lands, then it's easy enough to add in some of this stuff. Like, your Siege Rhinos for your Bring to Light deck aren't going to set you back very much. I just, you know, for as long as we've been in Magic, the mana bases have always been just about the most expensive part of playing Magic. So this is nothing new, but it's still worth grousing about.
Yeah, and I feel like they're getting to a point where they're finding that they can put more of these cards into dual decks, clash packs, you know, what have you. So they're kind of they stated that they're going to do a lot more reprints with this new block cadence, because it's not going to be in Standard so long, and it won't be as egregious to reprint like X card because it's not going to be around for that long. I just feel like, you know, we had, and just not to go off on a tangent about this Commander product, but they did release this Commander product. I feel like that's a good place to incorporate more stuff into Modern. You know, I understand it's only Legacy right now, but I feel like if they did incorporate Modern, that's another avenue to put cards back into Modern without having to go through Standard. So maybe that's something that they will consider. Obviously, this block cadence, along with them showing the willingness to include staple like cards and including mythics into an event deck or a clash pack, certainly is going to keep prices relatively sane throughout Standard, and we probably won't see a debacle like Jace for a while. I mean, we haven't seen it since the last time a Jace of this caliber was in Standard, and not to say that this Jace is Jace the Mind Sculptor, but there was, again, all these kind of different situations falling into place that Jace ended up being so good, as good as it is now. Those scenarios are going to go away. Fetch lands are going away. Cadence is going to kick in. It's going to rotate. It's not as dominant in Modern. So, with all that stuff coming into play, and again, going deeper into this cycle of two set blocks, them reprinting stuff into sealed product, that's definitely going to keep an overall cap on cards.
Well, let's jump into all of our Modern cards here, our Modern decks. There's a lot of cool stuff to talk about here. Two top eights. One was from Brazil, and one was a Star City Modern Premier Open, and we can dig into both of those. In short, first I want to start on the Brazilian one. There was a lot of Zoo, a lot of Burn, and kind of there's only one deck casting Snapcasters, which was Blue Red Twin. The Star City event, by the way, this is my big trivia, no Snapcasters in the top eight there either. The only place you see Snapcasters is in 18th place Jund at the unrelated Ricky Lin's deck in Star City. So very, very, very few Snapcasters. Not a great week for it. One point I'll make before we get into the list is that something you have to be aware about with Brazil is that they have a pretty hefty import duty. So it doesn't surprise me that decks that do not pack $800 in fetch lands are not top eighting. It's just sort of the nature of what's available. And listeners from Brazil are more familiar with it, feel free to write in and correct us. But this is not surprising to me that there may be not budget decks by any means, but perhaps something a little bit more reasonable to play that is still tier one. So with that, Chaz, I want to toss it over to you. Why don't you tell me what you love about this Brazilian top eight?
Well, the good thing is like you said, not a lot of Snapcaster Mage and not a lot of blue. Naya in all forms, Naya Company, Naya Burn, take your pick, was the top four decks of the tournament. And I really like Collected Company deck lists. I think they're really fun. Again, we talked about this last cast. We're seeing more Knight of the Reliquary, even in just the Company decks, along with these Retreat to Coralhelm decks starting to show up. We're seeing a lot of Noble Hierarch still, so all these cards that we kind of talked about last cast are still showing up in Modern in a big way. I more wanted to kind of point out Dallas, since we kind of got a little more information out of there. It was essentially the same thing: a lot of Burn, a lot of Zoo, not a lot of Snapcaster Mages there either, and even less Jace. Now, you know, since we talked about Jace, so the 12th place list by Justin McGuire, Hulk Footsteps, a new combo deck, if you want to call it, based around Protean Hulk, and subsequently Protean Hulk foils have increased from that, from what I've noticed. And then we saw a couple Scapeshift decks, like we talked about last week, and I asked you, Doug, if Scapeshift is suddenly becoming a little more popular, and I've seen that a couple of these lists are playing copies of Bring to Light, and I would assume that's because these are basically Scapeshift copies 5 through 7, because we did talk about that list kind of relies on Scapeshift a little bit too much, so without drawing a Scapeshift, you could draw into a Bring to Light, and that's essentially drawing a Scapeshift. Grixis Control showed up as a 2 of in the top 32 at Dallas, sporting Jace, but didn't really find its way into the top 8. Again, a lot of aggro in both of these tournaments. So that's interesting, because Zoo suddenly broke out. We saw this deck list, the Flint Hoof Boar, Burning Tree Emissary, kind of switch from the traditional red-green to incorporating white a little bit for the Wild Nactyl. So that's interesting.
We are seeing more Scapeshift, a whole lot more. The 18th place deck was running 3 Bring to Light, trying to make the Bring to Light do more work by playing like Damnation, Hunting Wilds, things like that. The abundance of Zoo everywhere really shocked me, because I have basically written Zoo off as being like a even worse Burn deck, whereas Burn is a good enough deck. Zoo is kind of worse, but it was surprising to see a lot of it, and not even people trying to do unfun or unfair things like get some sort of Malira combo going, but just running like here's some Wild Nacatls, just deal with them. If you are playing, like I got creamed by a Naya Zoo deck a while back when I was playing Splinter Twin, because they just had like the two Kasali Pride Mages in play. And when your plan post board is ideally hope to sweep the board with Anger of the Gods, but if you can't do that, combo off, it's really, really hard to get through two Kasali Pride Mages. And that was just a perpetual annoyance. And the deck is getting a lot better at dealing even with the combo decks that it normally would have a bad time with.
Yeah, I mean, Zoo obviously is coming. It was kind of its breakout party right here. Like you said, we haven't seen it too much, but it was still a contender. I did watch the finals, and Zoo just looked a lot better than Burn. I mean, there's not really much they can do when you're going Experiment 1, Curd Ape, Wild Nactyl, like deal with all this stuff. So they just really, your creatures in Zoo are a lot better than theirs. When you really look down, like, pound for pound. So I think that's kind of where Burn fell behind really quickly, is because, you know, they're holding a grip full of Burn, which is great, but you're basically playing a bunch of 3/3+ creatures every turn. So, and you don't really have to deal with any kind of, well, am I going to get blown out by a sweeper, blah, blah, blah. You just play all your creatures and just go to town and just let Burn kind of deal with it, which more often than not, they can't. Yeah, the top eight was interesting on both accounts, so I don't know what it means going forward. What I do know is Scapeshift, again, we talked about it last week, so I'm sticking with Scape Shift as a card to pick up. Barring any reprint, I mean, this is looking pretty good with retail copies at $20 and buy list is at $15 right now. The next available buy list at $13 or $12.50 rather. So that's still pretty good margins. I mean, we're looking at a 22% spread. Just pretty good.
And also, if you want to get involved in that and you don't want to spend $20 on Scapeshift, then Obstinate Baloth, which has been reprinted or printed only once, is only $2 if you're buying it from Star City. I mean, you can get them cheaper. But Baloth is a 4-of in that deck, albeit on the sideboard, and you see it crop up in decks like Jund and even the teamer builds a Splinter Twin. So for the listeners who want the low-cost option, that's one of your solutions there.
Yeah, and just a couple other real quick things just to recap both both of these modern tournaments as best I can. So we saw a little bit of movement. Allies is in the top 30 again. And so at this point, I can say that Allies is definitely a deck that can put up a good result at a tournament. To dig a little deeper, no matter what ally deck ends up showing up, you can be sure that the core of this deck is Akum Battlesinger, Hada Freeblade, and Kabira Evangel. And we've seen a pretty drastic increase on Kabira over the weekend, going from about $1 to about $5.50 retail. So that bodes well for anyone who has been sitting on that for a while. And, of course, foils of those two. Like I said before, the foil Protean Hulk has been increased significantly from this 12th place finish of Hulk Footsteps. It seems really fun. A different kind of take on any kind of combo obviously sparks an immense amount of interest. And yeah, so those are some takeaways from the deck, or from the top 32 list, is Allies, the Scapeshift list, and the Hulk Footsteps list by Justin McGuire.
So I also think that the Allies list, it bears mentioning that Ally Encampment is,
yeah,
or was, a bulk rare on MTGO. I should probably check its price today, but yesterday, as the tournament was going on, I was on MTGO, and I was like, I wonder if these are cheap, and it turns out they were almost at the bare minimum that a rare can get to. I think that card was looked at early as being like an all-star card, and Allies is going to be so good, and then the hype wore off, and people realized that like one set of Allies does not make up for two sets of Abzan and two sets of Jeskai. So like the card took a huge hit in its price, and it's probably still on the way down. I will venture that we will get more great Allies in Oath of the Gatewatch, and I think it's very likely that once Cons rotates, that Ally deck could be tier one. In the article that I'm publishing, probably by the time this podcast goes live, it will be up. Ally Encampment is definitely one of my bulk rare picks, as are almost all the other good rare Allies and Ally enablers from BFC.
Yeah. I look at this from a paper standpoint. I'm liking foils of this right now. There was kind of some initial hype. The price has gone down, and I think foils is actually a good play, because we obviously seen that Allies can contend, and you're right, Kelly, I think there's a couple more Allies in store for us in Oath of the Gatewatch. So yeah, me and Kelly kind of talked a little bit too, and one last thing to kind of draw from these modern tournaments, and we have talked about Jace. I'm like so tired of talking about Jace at this point, but by no means is this a bad card in modern. I'm not saying that. Like, obviously it has its place in modern, but that's it, really. It has its place in modern. It's not going to be a card that defines modern like it is in standard. The entire metagame is not going to warp around Jace, as we've seen here. And even you can look at Moto dailies. You can look at the States lists. You can look at these two, Dallas and Porto Alegre. So there's a lot of data out there now to, you know, quantify that Jace is not, it's a good card in modern, but that's it. Like, it's just a good card in modern, and it doesn't warp the format. And we discussed that maybe, you know, if you took your profits by now, that's great. If you want to kind of speculate and don't want to let go of the Jace train, then maybe, you know, if you want to keep these cards, maybe look to investing into foils, because foils really historically are safer than normal copies these days, especially now that they've kind of taken the action to reprint a lot of this stuff. Usually it's not in foil. So foils definitely can hold its price or increase if Jace somehow ends up being better in modern, or, you know, even if it's worse in modern, I think foils are still a good investment going forward to not only have the Jaces for modern, but you don't have to worry as much about the volatility of the non-copies of it. So if you want to chime in on that, Kelly, go ahead.
No, I think you covered it, Jess.
All right, yeah. So, I like I said, Jace foils, you can look at that because, yeah, for all the reasons I stated.
Looking at both of the top eights, I headed into this modern discussion, and I'll restate it, that this has just been a bad week for blue. I don't think it's a bad color in the format, but decks that are base blue often have a hard time dealing with very aggressive strategies because you can't remand a Wild Nacatl, you can't remand a Loxodon Smiter, and remanding like a Kasali Pride Mage works for one turn and that's it. It's really hard to stem the bleeding on that kind of stuff. So while I still think Snapcaster is going to be one of the bedrocks of the format in Modern, this is maybe hopeful for people to see that there are other strategies you can play that do not involve playing, you know, the $800 mana base. But there are also lots of decks that will kill people if you're doing that. So be careful when you're investing in that kind of stuff if you're picking up Modern cards to actually buy cards that you think are good. You know, if in 8 weeks we still see that there's just no Snapcasters and no Scalding Tarns breaking through to the main stage, then maybe we'll revisit everything.
Yeah, like, you know, we're going to start getting to the point where they're going to be looking to reprint Innistrad stuff. Obviously, we got the announcement that we're going back to Innistrad, but I would temper expectations to Fire Cell, like Snapcaster Mage and Liliana the Veil and Cavern of Souls or what have you. That those all can certainly be in there, but there's, you know, not everything is going to be in there. So I just find it hard to, you know, you just kind of have to sit there and think about, like, what would they actually really reprint? Like, I find it hard to believe that they would put Snapcaster Mage and Jace Friends Prodigy, like, in the same standard. So just kind of bear that in mind when you're looking to, you know, get rid of some of the cards that could be in Innistrad 2.0.
Uh-huh. Well, we have talked about two huge tournaments right now, post-Battle for Zendikar. Modern has had a bit of a scene shift that doesn't really rely on a whole lot of new cards being printed, but people trying new strategies, so that's interesting to see. We've also seen what I think is the most innovative, new, interesting top eight so far, which is from Grand Prix Indy, which had over 1,100 players, so that's worth noting. It was a really big tournament. Things like Hardened Scales, Black-White Tokens, the strategy of running counter spells to just run out a threat and defend it and things like that. New interesting strategies. I'm happy about it. And more to discuss next week. We've got some more big tournaments coming up. If you want to get a hold of us, you can reach me on Twitter. My handle there is at QuietSpec. And I hope to hear from you. And until next week, I'm Doug.
I'm Kelly.
I'm Chess.
And you've been listening to QS Cast.